KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of trying to keep people from voting in this country. Before 1965, if you were African American, it was incredibly difficult to vote or even register. But then came the Voting Rights Act. But here's the thing. The investigative journalist Ari Berman says more than 50 years later, we're once again fighting this fight. We'll be right back.
You hear stories on KUER. They make you think and laugh. Sometimes they frustrate you. And sometimes they even make you cry. When that happens, what's the first thing you want to do? Share the story, of course. And thankfully, local stories you hear on the air wind up at KUER.org. You'll find news, podcasts, and all the Radio West you want, plus community events. When you hear a story you love, spread the love at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the investigative journalist Ari Berman is joining us. We were looking for someone to explain the history of voter suppression in this country, and Berman has been exploring that history for years now. It's a history that goes way back, of course, to a time when African Americans couldn't vote at all, to the time after the Civil War when there were poll taxes and literacy tests and physical intimidation, and he says those conditions persisted until 1965. That was the year the Voting Rights Act was passed. So a good part of our conversation is about that history. But the story is particularly relevant today because Berman says over the last couple of decades, there has been what he believes is a concerted effort to undermine that act for partisan political reasons, to make it more difficult to vote. Since 2010, for example, Berman says more than 20 states have adopted restrictions on voting. Tens of thousands of voters have been purged from the polls. There have been restrictions on early voting. Polling places have been closed down. Really strict voter ID laws have been passed. Ari Berman is a senior reporter for Mother Jones and a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute. It's the media nonprofit associated with The Nation magazine. He has a book called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It came out in 2015. And he joined us to talk about the two parts of this story, the history part and the part today. We began our conversation with the history part. And I asked him, before 1965, the year the Voting Rights Act was passed, if you were African American living in this country, in the South, what was it like if you wanted to try and vote?
If you were an African-American person in the South in the 1960s before the Voting Rights Act, it was virtually impossible to vote in some places. There were counties in Alabama, counties in Mississippi, where there wasn't a single black voter, where simply trying to register to vote was first off incredibly difficult. And then secondly, the whole culture of the South had an intimidating effect where you could lose your job, you could lose your land, you could potentially lose your life for simply trying to register to vote. So if you wanted to register, for example, in Selma, Alabama, which was one of the worst places in terms of segregation, African American voters had to name all 67 county judges to be able to get on the voting rolls. Obviously, that was impossible to do. That was known as the kind of literacy test that voters were given. I mean, the 67 county judges themselves would have never been able to do that. But that was the kind of things that were done. The registration office in Selma was only open once a month. And when people who were African American tried to go there, they just would take – the registrars would just take an incredibly long lunch break. They would come back and they say, registration's closed for the day. So even if you somehow got in the building, you are never going to be able to register to vote. If you succeeded in registering, let's say you somehow were able to pass this literacy test or you were able to pay a poll tax, then often your name would be printed in the newspaper with your address. So suddenly all the white segregationists in town knew where you lived. So both the actual impediments, the literacy test, the poll taxes, and then the whole culture of the South of violence and intimidation kept many African Americans from even trying to register to vote, let alone successfully registering and then voting.
You tell about a joke that some voting rights lawyers would tell in the 1960s to talk about just how incredibly impossible it was. A black college professor, fluent in multiple languages, walks into a county registrar's office in the Deep South. The registrar hands him a paper in Chinese and says, okay, that's your literacy test. Can you read that? And the professor says, I can read that real good. And the registrar says, what does it say? And the answer is, ain't no black people voting in this county this year.
Yeah, that basically sums it up. I mean, the thing about these literacy tests and other impediments was that most white people were never asked these questions.
Yeah.
I mean, there were a ton of illiterate white people in the South that would have never been able to pass these ridiculous literacy tests. There were also some very, very well-educated African-Americans who just weren't able to register to vote. So it wasn't just the fact that you had discriminatory laws on the books. It was that they were applied in a discriminatory manner. And basically, the entire system was set up to make it virtually impossible for African Americans to register to vote. You had some pockets in the South where there was more of a black middle class, where they had some political power, places like Atlanta, for example, where some African Americans, like Martin Luther King's family, were able to register to vote. But when you got to the rural South, what we think of as the black belt of the South, places like rural Georgia or rural Alabama or rural Mississippi, it was just so impossible for African Americans to register to vote. There was so much intimidation. There was so much fear. Segregationists ran everything that most people didn't even try to register. And when they did, it was just impossible in those cases.
In the book, you mentioned those really dramatic days, 8 days, in fact, before President Lyndon Johnson introduces the Voting Rights Act. Wanted to have you talk about that that particular moment, because that gives us really some really important context for all of this. This is the tension and conflict, of course, going on over the civil rights movement.
Well, the pivotal day for the Voting Rights Act is March 7th, 1965.
Yeah.
And what happens on that day is that 800 civil rights activists, led by John Lewis, who is the president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, now a very well-known congressman from Georgia, he leads a march. And the reason why they lead this march is that a few weeks earlier, a young black man by the name of Jimmie Lee Jackson was murdered in Perry County, Alabama, next to Selma, Alabama, during a night civil rights march. And Jimmie Lee Jackson was someone who had tried to register to vote 5 different times and was blocked from registering and then was shot by Alabama state troopers during a night march in Marion, Alabama, which was next to Selma, Alabama. So the idea was that civil rights activists were going to march in Selma. They were going to march from Selma to Montgomery, the state capital, and they were going to try to carry Jimmie Lee Jackson's casket. Now, that was an unworkable idea, but they decided nonetheless they were going to begin a march from Selma to Montgomery. And so John Lewis and Hosea Williams, another civil rights activist, they're marching in front, and there's a whole row of people marching essentially two by two behind them. And they cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is named after a former Confederate general in Selma, Alabama. And when they get across this bridge, Alabama state troopers are waiting for them. And they have gas masks on, they're on horses, they're carrying whips. And basically what they do is they storm into the civil rights demonstrators. They beat them with billy clubs. They whip them from horsebacks. Tear gas is shot everywhere. It's an incredibly chaotic scene. But the media is there. And what happens that night is that ABC cuts in to its primetime premiere of Judgment at Nuremberg, a film about Nazi Germany. And many confused viewers think that the images from Selma are actually of Nazi Germany. But this is happening not in Germany, but in the segregated South. And the images of people like John Lewis being beaten over the head with billy clubs and tear gassed and whipped and trampled by horses, this shocks the nation. And even though there's been a lot of violence towards civil rights demonstrators before, this march in Selma, Alabama has an impact like nothing else. And at that point in time, Lyndon Johnson and the other political officials in the country have no choice but to push a Voting Rights Act through Congress.
Let's talk about the options that President Johnson is exploring. He asks the Justice Department to come up with some options, and they do. They give him these three particular options. One of them is a constitutional amendment. Another is this this federal commission. It seems like they went with a third option, I guess, and that is for the federal government to assume control of registration, both in federal and in state elections. And this, of course, is the fairly controversial part. But just would you talk about that part, just like the development of this idea of the Voting Rights Act?
So the big picture here is that Lyndon Johnson wants to do a Voting Rights Act, but he's not totally sure about the timing. He had signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in July of that year. And so when civil rights activists led by Martin Luther King go to see Johnson in December of 1964 and tell them that they're going to go to Selma to try to pass a Voting Rights Act, Johnson basically tells them, I want to do this, but it's going to take some time. Yeah. But at the same time, he's kind of noncommittal with King. He starts to tell the Justice Department, work this out for me. Give me some options in case we need to do this more quickly. And basically what the Justice Department settles on is devising legislation that will knock out the literacy tests that have prevented so many people, so many African Americans from registering to vote in the South. Because you had a situation where, you know, as I mentioned, you had to name all 67 county judges to get on the voting rolls. Those kind of tests they wanted to get rid of via legislation because the process of challenging these laws through the court was so slow and tedious that even when you got a decision that might strike down a literacy test or a poll tax, states like Alabama just passed a new one, and then you had to challenge it all over again. So they wanted to knock out these things through the legislative process, and then they wanted to send federal officials to the South to register voters and to oversee state elections to make sure that people were actually registered, that states comply with the law, and that ultimately elections weren't stolen. So that piece of legislation, what eventually became the Voting Rights Act, was both the fastest and most workable piece of legislation that was going to solve the problem of voter suppression in the South.
Let's talk about the speech that President Johnson gives. This is in March 15th. It's a speech to Congress. And I want to play a couple of moments here. Would you set this up for us, Ari? I think you mentioned in your book something like 70 million Americans are tuned in.
It was an absolutely remarkable speech by Lyndon Johnson. You have to remember, this was a guy who, when he represented Texas in the U.S. House, voted against every civil rights bill for his first 20 years in Congress. So he was as segregationist as anybody else in the Congress at that time. He was just like any other Southern Democrat. Yeah. Then when he joins the Senate and eventually becomes Senate Majority Leader, he starts becoming more progressive on civil rights, starts moving civil rights bills. And then when he becomes president after John F. Kennedy's assassination, he signs the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so after Bloody Sunday, after the atrocities in Selma, when John Lewis and so many others were brutally beaten, Johnson knew he had to move quickly. That there wasn't just the march in Selma, but there were marches all across the country. Suddenly, there were thousands of people demonstrating in New York and Boston and Detroit and all these other cities. And there was a ton of pressure on Johnson to do something. And so he gives this speech. He says he wants to address a joint session of Congress. And he basically gives this speech on March 15th, 1965, 8 days after Bloody Sunday, laying out the Voting Rights Act and talking about why it's so important.
At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. There, long-suffering men and women peacefully protested the denial of their rights as Americans. Many were brutally assaulted. One good man, a man of God, was killed. There is no cause for pride in what has happened in Selma. There is no cause for self-satisfaction in the long denial of equal rights of millions of Americans. But there is cause for hope and for faith in our democracy and what is happening here tonight.
You write about how the speech was written by a former Kennedy speechwriter, Richard Goodwin. And you talk about how it brilliantly framed the cause of voting rights, that it wasn't about black and white, but he framed it as between right and wrong.
I still get chills, Doug, every time I hear that speech. It is one of the most remarkable speeches ever delivered by an American president. And what Lyndon Johnson did was he framed the right to vote as a universal fundamental right. He says very famously in his speech, there is no Southern problem. There is no Negro problem. There is only an American problem, which meant that when African Americans were disenfranchised in the South, it affected all of us as a country, that America could not be the country that exported democracy all across the world when we were disenfranchising our own citizens at home. And when he said during his speech, "We shall overcome," it was one of the most powerful moments in American history. Martin Luther King and John Lewis were sitting in Selma, Alabama, in the living room of a local dentist. And this place was kind of the hub of the civil rights movement in Selma. And Martin Luther King cried during that speech. And I asked John Lewis about it. And John Lewis said, to go from being beaten on Bloody Sunday to 8 days later having the president say, "We shall overcome," it was almost too much, the emotions that we were going through. We never thought we'd see an American president say the words, say the rallying cry of the civil rights movement. So it was a transformative piece. It was a transformative speech. And once Lyndon Johnson gave it, there was no doubt that the Voting Rights Act was going to pass.
That's Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. His book is called Give Us the Ballot: The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of trying to keep people from voting in this country. We have with us Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. He wrote a book back in 2015 called Give Us the Ballot: The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, let's talk about what happened after the Voting Rights Act passed. You say the Justice Department really wasted no time implementing the law, and they drew up this list of what you called these first-tier counties, counties that had really bad histories of voting discrimination. Talk about how it plays out after it's passed.
So after the Voting Rights Act is passed, things like literacy tests are knocked down through the legislation. Then the Attorney General files suits to get rid of poll taxes in all of these southern states. And then just a few days after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, federal officials are sent to the South, to the worst, most segregationist counties in the South, to begin registering black voters. And this is huge because you have places like Selma, Alabama, where only 2% of African Americans are registered to vote, where virtually nobody has been registered for decades because the people that are running the elections are segregationist white officials. Right. Suddenly you have the federal government show up and they say, "We're open for business." And so you go from having nobody who's African American being able to register for decades to suddenly hundreds of people registering every day, to having federal officials helping people register to vote, advertising that they should register, the federal government encouraging people to register to vote. This was a revolutionary change in the South. We hadn't seen anything like this since Reconstruction.
You write about this couple, Ardis Malden and her husband Thomas, and their going to register in, and I think it was in Mobile, Alabama. You write about them, how they were the first. And just you write about how once they were able to do this, remarkable, obviously, as you say. But then as they walked out, there was this line that went out the door and then went out around the block. I mean, people were in line trying to get that franchise.
I believe that the Maldens were the first people to register to vote, or among the first people to register to vote in Selma, Alabama, that their son Charles had been beaten on Bloody Sunday along with John Lewis. And he really inspired them to get active. And they were someone, they were a more elderly African-American couple that was afraid to even try to register to vote. But when the civil rights demonstrations happened, they got active. And one of the things that I found so fascinating is LBJ kept that certificate of registration. He had a copy made. And when Thurgood Marshall became the first African-American appointed to the Supreme Court, LBJ gave Thurgood Marshall this voting certificate from the first people registered under the Voting Rights Act. So this meant a tremendous amount to LBJ. It meant a tremendous amount to the country. And it meant a tremendous amount to people that had tried so many times to register and were unable to. And you went from hundreds of people being turned away from registering to suddenly there being lines around the corridors of these government buildings of people who are suddenly able to register to vote for the first time.
What was the reaction you were getting from opponents? What were the cases that they were making at the time? You mentioned in the book it didn't take long for segregationists to try to turn to the courts to challenge all of it. But what was the argument that they were making, that it was overreach, I guess, or something?
The rhetoric was very reminiscent of the Civil War, that basically Southern governors argued that this was an invasion by the federal government, that suddenly here was the federal government all over again, just like they did during Reconstruction, taking over the sovereignty of Alabama and the sovereignty of Mississippi and the sovereignty of Georgia, and telling us how we're going to run elections and letting all of these illiterate African Americans who have no business being registered suddenly register to vote. That's basically their language. I mean, it was a classic states' rights argument. And they immediately challenged the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. I think the first challenge was filed within a few weeks. And pretty much every Southern state challenge the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and in very short order, this went to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. South Carolina prided itself on being first when it came to Southern resistance. So their name appeared on that first – on that case that goes before the Supreme Court. South Carolina versus Katzenbach, which is Nicholas Katzenbach of the Justice Department. Talk a little bit about the case. The Supreme Court begins oral arguments January 1966. And it's interesting you say by that time, 250,000 black voters had been added to the rolls in these seven southern states that were covered by the law.
So South Carolina and a bunch of other southern states challenged the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. The case was actually argued by the attorney general, Nicholas Katzenbach, which is very rare. That almost never happens nowadays, who was also named as the defendant in the case. It took place on his birthday.
Right.
And the arguments lasted 2 days. It was one of the longest arguments before the Supreme Court in American history. And basically, the southern states were arguing that the federal government was trying to take over their election laws in violation of the Constitution, because the Constitution gives a lot of power to states to run their elections. What the federal government was saying was that they were essentially enforcing the 15th Amendment of 1870, which said that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race or color, and that those words had essentially been abandoned for nearly 100 years. And that the Voting Rights Act was constitutional because it was simply enforcing a constitutional amendment that had gone unenforced through almost all of Jim Crow. Wow. And ultimately, the argument of the federal government prevailed. It was an 8-1 decision that came out right around the first anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And I mean, that should have settled it. That should have settled the debate over the Voting Rights Act. Usually when the Supreme Court upheld something by a vote of 8-1, that's usually the whole ball game. But that was not the end of the story.
Yeah, it's not. Which will get us to 2000, which you I want to say this, though, first, because I do think it's interesting and somewhat poignant that someone asked President Johnson what he thought was his greatest achievement. And he mentioned this. He mentioned the Voting Rights Act.
He did, because I think President Johnson was keenly aware of political power and how it works. I mean, Robert Caro has written, I believe, 4 books now. He's working on his 5th about how Lyndon Johnson wielded political power, that he understood how to use power in a way unlike any other politician. And I think Johnson knew at the end of the day that the vote was the one thing that conferred political power, that you could pass all sorts of civil rights laws, but that if people didn't have the right to vote, it wouldn't mean anything. And as a native Southerner, even though Johnson had voted for so many anti-civil rights bills early in his career, I think he innately understood the problem of discrimination. He talked in his speech when he introduced the Voting Rights Act about teaching in a poor school for Latinos in rural South Texas and the discrimination he saw. And I think that stayed with him his entire life. And I think he was someone who really believed in an expansive role for government. And you saw that not just in voting rights, but in all the other things he did, whether it was things like, you know, Medicare and Medicaid or the whole Great Society program. But I think he really believed that the Voting Rights Act was an example of the federal government using its power for the ultimate good and solving a problem that had bedeviled the South for nearly a century, and in fact was a problem as old as American history itself, because at the beginning of our country, only white male property owners could vote. And suddenly in 1965, you had a law that for the first time said that everyone should be able to vote free from racial discrimination. And so I think Johnson knew that the Voting Rights Act was going to be something that had a power that far outlived him.
So you've dated the beginning of this modern effort to restrict voting rights, I think, to the 2000 election. And you really focus on Florida. Talk about that, because that seemed like a turning point.
It seemed like a turning point, and a turning point in a way that a lot of people don't realize, because the narrative during the 2000 election in Florida, when there was a 36-day recount between Al Gore and George W. Bush, focused on things like butterfly ballots and hanging chads and Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State, and it focused on all of these technical issues that plagued that election. And then afterwards, there was attempts like the Help America Vote Act of 2002 to try to stop that, and people said, you know, this can never happen again. But there was an entirely different thing that happened during the 2000 election in Florida that got almost no attention, which was that Florida was one of only a handful of states that prevented ex-felons from voting. Right. So even after you served your time, paid your debt to society, you still couldn't vote in Florida. And the state said that all of these ex-felons, that thousands of ex-felons, were illegally registered to vote and needed to be purged from the voting rolls in the run-up to the 2000 election in Florida. The problem with this voter purge was that, first off, it was inaccurate. People were being labeled as felons when they weren't. And secondly, it was discriminatory, that African Americans in Florida were 11% of the electorate, but 44% of those on this voter purge list that was sent to the different counties. And so on Election Day, all of these people that were eligible to vote, that were registered to vote, showed up and they were told that they were ex-felons. They couldn't vote. And after the election, the NAACP sued the state of Florida, and the state of Florida said that 12,000 registered voters were wrongly labeled as felons and prevented from voting. And that was 22 times George W. Bush's 537-vote margin of victory in that state. And so at the same time, everyone was saying, oh, this can never happen again. We can never have another Florida 2000. Some elements, particularly in the Republican Party, realized that small manipulations to the country's voting rules could give them a big advantage in close elections. And so Florida was a turning point in a way that we don't usually realize, because we think it's a turning point in terms of spotlighting problems with our voting system. And that's absolutely true. But it really was a turning point in convincing elements of the Republican Party that actually this kind of thing could benefit them in future elections.
Ari, is that true in the sense that just the most minor tweaking, does that make it difficult for some people to take the trouble to go out and register to vote or to go out and vote? I mean, has that proven to be true, that the lesson the Republicans seem to have learned from that 2000 election?
Well, I think that the data has shown that when you make it harder to vote, fewer people vote.
Yeah.
I mean, that both makes anecdotal sense, and I think that the literature on this backs it up, that if suddenly you tell people they need an ID that they never needed in any previous election, or that suddenly they have less time to vote than before, or suddenly they have fewer polling places, or suddenly they've been removed from the voter rolls, or suddenly they've been gerrymandered in such a way that their vote is essentially doesn't matter, or that somehow the qualifications change, and if you committed a mistake and you went to jail, and even if you've served your time, you still can't vote. Yes, absolutely. That's going to impact an election. And it depends on how strict the rule is. It depends on how many people are affected. It depends on how close the election is. So it depends on all of those circumstances. But it's absolutely true that efforts to make it harder to vote have had an impact in elections, not just in Florida in 2000, but I talk about in my book in Ohio in 2004. Mm-hmm. So just 4 years later, one of the things that happened in Ohio was that there were many fewer voting machines in counties that tended to vote Democratic and in urban areas like Cleveland and Columbus. So if you were someone who lived in an affluent suburb of Columbus, you may have had no line to vote. But if you were someone that lived in a much busier inner city that was a lot more diverse, that was more Democratic, that had more African Americans, you had many fewer voting machines. So there were 5-hour lines in places like Cleveland and Columbus. And that led a lot of people to leave. That led over 100,000 people to leave, according to a post-election study. So if you have new hurdles to voting, some people will jump through them, but others will say, they'll do a cost-benefit analysis and they'll say, it's just not worth it to me.
Yeah.
Or even if I try, I'm not going to be able to fulfill this new requirement. And I think that's what's going on here. It's not just that you're flat out preventing people from voting. You're just making the process so difficult or inconvenient that they don't even try, or that even if they do try, they can't comply with the law.
You write in your book that before 2010, only 3 states had passed these really strict voter ID laws. I think it was Indiana and Georgia and Missouri was the third. But then after 2010, I think like 9 states started adopting them, a lot more. What's going on in 2010?
And it wasn't just voter ID laws. We saw a wave of new restrictions on voting, not just requiring voter ID, which I know people often get hung up on arguing about, but things like cutting early voting,
yeah,
or making it harder to register to vote, or more aggressively purging the voter rolls, or disenfranchising ex-felons. That from 2011 to 2012 alone, nearly half the states in the country changed their voting laws in one way or another to make it harder to vote. And we hadn't seen anything like this previously, certainly in the modern history of our country. And I think what happened was that Republicans took control of so many key states. They took control of places in 2010 like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida and Wisconsin, states that President Obama had won in 2008. And they saw the record turnout for President Obama in 2008. And that set off alarm bells among Republicans, because you had 5 million new voters cast a ballot in 2008. And of those 5 million new voters, 2 million were African American, 2 million were Hispanic, 750,000 were Asian American, and they voted 75% for President Obama. So suddenly the fastest growing demographics in the country were voting in record numbers for the first black president. This was dubbed the Coalition of the Ascendant, and it was believed that this would become the new normal in American politics. And so Republicans, once they won an election, tried to get some sort of electoral advantage. And they tried to get some sort of electoral advantage by trying to change the country's voting laws to make it harder for the core of the Obama coalition, particularly people of color, lower income folks, younger folks, first-time voters, to participate. And all of these laws, in one way or another, disproportionately hurt core elements of Barack Obama's coalition. So I think that was the larger political strategy behind this.
One of the things you talk about in the book is that this push for voter ID laws didn't just come out of nowhere. You talk about this man named Paul Weyrich, who was one of the main drivers of some of these organized efforts. And I wanted you to just talk a little bit about him, because he said infamously at some point, "I don't want everyone to vote." I mean, so just talk a little bit about this part of the story.
Paul Weyrich was a very influential conservative activist. He helped found the Heritage Foundation and a bunch of other organizations. And he spoke in 1980 at a big meeting of religious leaders for Ronald Reagan. And he got up and he gave this fiery speech, and he basically said, "Too many of our leaders have the goo-goo syndrome," what he called the good governance syndrome. And he said, "I don't want everyone to vote." He said, quite frankly, "Our leverage in elections goes up as the voting populace goes down." And I think that was the ideological case for having fewer people vote, that when there was a large turnout, when African-Americans, Latinos, Asian-Americans, younger people who don't always vote in every election, when they turned out in 2008, it led to the first black president. But when voter turnout was lower, that tended to benefit Republicans, who were more affluent voters, who were more reliable voters, who were whiter voters. And so what happens is, one of the things that Weyrich does is he helps found a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC. Yeah. And they're a group that pairs corporations with state legislators. And basically, they write bills for state legislators. Most state legislators work part-time. They don't get paid that much money. And so a lot of their agenda comes from the outside. And ALEC wrote mock voter ID legislation after 2008. And suddenly that legislation was introduced virtually word for word in state after state after state. Usually what's going on in Pennsylvania is different than what's going on in Texas. Mm-hmm. These are states that have very different priorities. But suddenly you saw the same piece of legislation introduced virtually identically, whether it was in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or in Texas. And a lot of that was because of ALEC, and a lot of that was because Republicans decided that they were going to make this a prominent strategy, that they were going to make restricting voting rights a prominent strategy once they took power following Barack Obama's election.
Where does Chief Justice John Roberts fit in that, as far as we can tell, that ideological idea? Because one of the things you've talked about and written about is that Roberts has this kind of long history of being ambivalent about or even hostile to these voting rights, the Voting Rights Act. Where does he fit in that story, do you think?
Well, it's interesting. Roberts comes out of what I would say is a slightly different but complementary ideological movement. He doesn't really think of these things in terms of politics, Republicans versus Democrats. But Roberts is someone who comes of age during the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s. He clerks for Justice William Rehnquist, the most conservative justice on the Supreme Court on civil rights issues. And then he goes and works for the Reagan administration. And the Reagan administration had a radically different view of civil rights, because basically, up until that time, you had the administrations that followed the Johnson administration enforcing the Voting Rights Act. I mean, there were fights about this in the Nixon administration and the Ford administration, and the Carter administration. But it was really Reagan who comes in with a very different view of civil rights. That the belief in the Reagan administration is one of what they call colorblindness. Mm-hmm. And their belief is that any laws that consider race, even if it's to remedy racial discrimination, are in and of themselves racist. That the solutions for discrimination are as bad as the original sin. And Roberts is a true believer in this. So when Roberts joins the Reagan Justice Department, one of the things is that parts of the Voting Rights Act are temporary and have to be reauthorized by the Congress. And there's a huge fight in the Congress over whether to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act and how strong the Voting Rights Act should be when it's reauthorized. And Roberts basically leads the effort within the Reagan Justice Department to try to weaken the Voting Rights Act. In Roberts' words, he says that violations of the Voting Rights Act should not be made too easy to prove, because it will lead to things like quotas for minority elected officials. So Roberts is making a kind of a different case than Paul Weyrich. He's not saying, "I don't want everyone to vote because that's going to benefit Republicans." He's making more of an ideological case that, in his words, even if the Voting Rights Act was well-intentioned, the solutions that flow from the Voting Rights Act – for example, more minority elected officials are a form of what he calls affirmative action in the electoral sphere. And so when he joins the Supreme Court, he has a record on civil rights issues that is very much at odds with the people that drafted and supported the Voting Rights Act.
It's interesting you write about when he was going through the confirmation process that some of the senators, some of the Democratic senators, Senator Kennedy in particular, challenged him on this, said he didn't think, and I'll quote you, Senator Kennedy, as you do in the book. Kennedy said he said, I don't think you fully appreciate the problems of discrimination in our society. How did Roberts respond? What did he say during that confirmation process to defend himself?
Well, I don't think Roberts was fully forthcoming with the Congress because he basically gave this famous analogy of being an umpire, that he was just going to call balls and strikes. But in fact, Roberts had been a very active player when it came to his opposition of civil rights issues. He was very ideological on this front. And even though he told the Congress that he had no problems with the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, despite his earlier work in the Reagan Justice Department challenging the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. Once he became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, it became very clear that Roberts still had it out for the Voting Rights Act and that he wanted one of his legacies as Chief Justice to be rolling back the civil rights laws of the 1960s.
Brings us to 2013 and the Supreme Court taking on this challenge of the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 in particular of the Act. Set this part up for us, if you would, because I want to talk about what happens in the Supreme Court.
So Section 5 was a part of the Voting Rights Act that required states with the longest history of discrimination, largely in the South but not exclusively, to approve their voting changes with the federal government so that states wouldn't discriminate in the future. And this was a part of the law that honestly no one really thought much about in 1965. But after the Voting Rights Act was upheld as constitutional in 1966, what states like Alabama and Mississippi began to do was change their election laws to try to make it harder for African Americans who were newly registered to vote to actually be able to run and win elected office. So the fight over the Voting Rights Act shifted from simply being able to register to one of political power and representation. Were black voters actually going to be able to elect anyone of consequence in places like Alabama or Mississippi? And so suddenly the federal government started reviewing all of these voting changes from the southern states in particular. And they blocked a lot of voting changes. From 1965 to 2013, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act blocked 3,000 discriminatory voting changes. That was a tremendous amount of power the federal government had. I mean, they didn't have this power in really any other civil rights law to actually just stop discrimination in voting before it ever occurred. And this part of the Voting Rights Act was very unpopular with the southern states because they hated having to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And it was very unpopular with the conservative justices on the court who basically viewed this as another form of reconstruction of the South having to come before the federal government and beg to have their voting changes upheld. And so this was a part of the law that John Roberts really had it out for from the very beginning.
Roberts says the court then, of course, basically guts that provision. How much damage did it do to the essence of the Voting Rights Act?
That decision in 2013 in Shelby County versus Holder, it gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act because Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which allowed them to block discriminatory voting changes before they ever actually became law. That was the most important part of the Voting Rights Act. That was the part of the Voting Rights Act that had by far the most teeth. There were other parts of the Voting Rights Act that allowed you to challenge the discriminatory voting change, but this was the only part of the Voting Rights Act that was preemptive, that actually stopped discrimination before it ever occurred. So the way I think about it is like, it's like the federal government was able to stop a robbery from ever occurring. Compared to having your house robbed and then trying to figure out who robbed it. I mean, that was the difference in terms of what power the federal government had. And so suddenly what happened is that states like Alabama and Texas and Georgia that had had discriminatory voting laws blocked by the federal government, suddenly they were able to put these laws in place with no federal oversight. And if you wanted to challenge these laws, you had to go through a very lengthy litigation process, which was precisely the kind of thing the Voting Rights Act was supposed to outlaw in the first place, which is you strike down a literacy test in Alabama, they'll just pass a new one.
Yeah.
The Voting Rights Act changed that equation, but suddenly that's what you had now. If Texas had a voter ID law, well, guess what? You're going to have to challenge that in court. It was going to take years, and then it was going to be very difficult if the courts were filled with conservative judges to ever stop that law in the first place.
Roberts writes in the opinion that our country has changed. What do you make of that as an argument? How do you respond to that? That we're not the same way, that the South isn't the same kind of place, that we're different now.
Well, no one would argue with that. No one would argue that the South today is like it was in 1965. But I think critics of John Roberts' decision felt like he was only focusing on the progress that had been made, the election of the first black president, or the rise in black officials in places like Mississippi and Alabama, and was ignoring, first off, that a lot of this progress was because of the protections of the Voting Rights Act, but also that there were still a lot of barriers to people participating in the political process. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg had a great line in her dissent where she basically said, you don't throw out your umbrella just because you're not getting wet one day, that it was going to rain again, that the Voting Rights Act was that umbrella, that when it did rain, you could open it and you could stop from getting wet. And that's what the Voting Rights Act did, is it stopped discrimination in voting when that discrimination occurred. And when you got rid of those critical protections, it just meant that that discrimination, which Roberts basically claimed wasn't occurring, was more likely to occur.
Let's talk about the new Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh, because you've been writing about his inclination to be, you know, resistant to voting rights. And when he was a federal judge, he voted to uphold a South Carolina law that required voters to show this photo ID. What are you expecting from this new justice now?
I'm expecting that Brett Kavanaugh is going to be very similar to John Roberts and the other conservative justices when it comes to this. There really hasn't been much debate among the conservatives on the court about these kind of issues. I mean, Anthony Kennedy voted with Roberts to gut the Voting Rights Act and to uphold voter ID laws and other things like that. So I think there was already pretty much a consensus. And I think Kavanaugh is going to be within that consensus. He wrote an opinion upholding a voter ID law from South Carolina. And the Obama administration actually blocked that law under the Voting Rights Act and said that it would disenfranchise tens of thousands of minority voters who are less likely to have the IDs required. And that was something that Kavanaugh upheld. And I'm actually not even disturbed about that part of the opinion. What I'm disturbed about is Kavanaugh had language that basically said, even if there's no evidence of voter fraud, which is the purported justification for these laws, even if there's no evidence of such fraud, states have an interest in protecting the integrity of the ballot and basically can do whatever they want to restrict access to the ballot if they're concerned about voting integrity. That is an incredibly broad authority to suddenly give to states. Usually, if you do something to make it harder to vote, there has to be a very good reason for it. You actually have to show that there's some sort of threat that would necessitate a new voter ID law or purging the voting rolls or cutting a polling place or cutting back the amount of time that people had to vote. What Kavanaugh is basically saying is you don't even need that justification. You can just have this vague notion of wanting to protect integrity in the political process, and then you can make it harder for poor people, for African Americans, for Latinos, for young people to be able to vote. And I think that gives states a remarkable amount of leeway to potentially discriminate against people. I think that's really out of step with what the Voting Rights Act intended.
Let me ask you finally what you're expecting this Tuesday. I'll point out here in Utah, there's this initiative on the ballot to deal with partisan gerrymandering. And it seems like this is one of the things that's giving you a sense of hope. Because you say that it could go one of two ways. On one hand, we could see more voter suppression going on. But you also say that that's a possibility that this election could be remembered as the election where we're actually expanding voter rights.
That's right. It could go in two directions. We are seeing voter suppression efforts play out in states like Georgia and North Dakota and Kansas. That is all too obvious right now. And it's very disturbing that some people who want to cast a ballot might not be able to for one reason or another, and that could impact close races. On the other hand, there are ballot initiatives in seven states, including states like Utah, that are not thought of as liberal states, that would make it harder to gerrymander, that would make it easier to register to vote, that would restore voting rights to ex-felons. And I think a lot of these initiatives have a chance of passing, even in relatively conservative states. And what that tells me is that when you get beyond the political figures, when you talk to voters and you say, should we make it harder to gerrymander? Should we make it easier to participate? Should we lower the barriers of entry to get more people involved? I think there's broad support for that agenda that, yeah, people might support some restrictions on voting, like a voter ID law. But I think they're supportive of efforts like early voting and like automatic or election day registration. And they're supportive of legislators not drawing their own districts. So there's a lot of support at the local level for small D democracy. And I'm hoping that that's one of the things that emerges from the 2018 election, is that people look at how their elections are conducted, what the rules are, and see that how elections are conducted, what the rules are, what the voting protections are, that actually goes a long way to determining what kind of democracy we have.
That's Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter for Mother Jones Magazine and a reporting fellow at The Nation Institute. That's the media nonprofit associated with The Nation Magazine. His book, which came out in 2015, is called Give Us the Ballot: The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.